comics,
movies,
music,
video games,
technology,
Blu-ray,
television.
This is the HHWLOD Podcast Network.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com.
Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/outnowpodcast.
Over 150,000 titles to choose from for your Android, iPhone, Kindle, or MP3 player. This week on Out Now with Aaron and Abe, we're talking Inherent Vice and Selma.
Alabama?
The very same.
Wait a minute, I forgot my introduction.
We are now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and as always, this is...
Abe! Guten Tag!
Out Now is a film podcast. Abe and I discussing new movies weekly. We cover some various movie topics, jump into a mostly spoiler-free review, and then jump back into other fun movie topics. This is episode 177.
That's pretty good. That's pretty high. I'm pretty sure we're going to get to 178 pretty soon.
It's on the docket. That's what
on the docket? Yeah. All right, yeah. Planned.
Yeah. And we have a double... review this week, Abe. We're doing two movies. We have Inherent Vice and yeah. Selma.
I'm pretty sure that's called the double entendre, but
I don't think that.
All right.
But no, we got two movies. They've been, you know, kind of around in some theaters, but they finally came out in wider release this week. So like, why not do both of them, right? Why not give us more work?
I would agree. I mean, there's a lot of good movies that came out during the holiday season that we didn't get a chance to review, and here we are.
Here we are. Yeah. So with that in mind, we have. To go with our two reviews, we have two guests with us. We have, from M-Time, China, the man walked over many hippies to get here. It's Todd Gilchrist.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good. And also, from the Beverly Press, just finishing his plate of pancakes, it's Jonathan Van Dyke.
Hey, hey.
He's proud of those pancake finishing.
Yeah, he got it. And Todd, first time having you on. Good to have you on the show here.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
For sure. Always good to have... new guests on, and always good to have the old fuddy-duddies like Jonathan Van Dyke on as well.
Hey, if I can curmudgeon it up, so can you.
Okay. We love you, John.
I mean, I use the term fuddy-duddy, so clearly it is pretty old right now. All right, before we get to the main show here, let's do some show note stuff. Abe, I keep talking about new commentaries, don't I?
So we had a few scheduling issues. That's why we haven't had a lot of commentaries lately. But we plan on doing them.
Yeah, we have two fun ones planned. And who knows what it's 2015 now. There's all kinds of potential for various movies celebrating anniversaries coming up.
I mean,
new commentary.
Yeah, board. If you just want Aaron and I to do it alone, just upvote something on Facebook, and we'll just be like, fine, we'll do it.
Well, after our epic top 10 episode, which was a lot of fun, by the way.
It was.
And please feel free to listen to that one. So we did mention Winter's Tale, and then we, of course, got a Twitter response saying you guys should definitely do a commentary for Winter's Tale.
Irish accents.
We'll see. We'll see how that goes. Yeah. But yeah, new commentary should be coming at some point. We'll just put that out there right now.
Some point.
Yeah. And let's see. iTunes reviews and ratings. Good to get those. It helps out our show. It helps other people find our show. We, of course, have been getting a number of new reviews every so often. It's been really cool to read out in the show and everything. But yeah, you just log into iTunes. Give us a star rating, possibly write a little sentence or so. It, you know, really help out the show. And, yeah. Cool. Let's move on now. Let's get to know everybody. Where each week, Abe and I ask a few questions, try to set the tone for the podcast, and better get to
know everybody. Not too bad.
2015 first.
Yes, that's correct. I forgot. Yeah.
All right. I have a question.
Yeah.
Because Inherent Vice is... some people are not flocking to it and responding in the way that necessarily everyone would like love for it to be. I have to ask, what do you consider a weird movie? Like, if someone says something's a weird movie, what does that mean to you?
Who would you like to start?
Any of you.
Typically, I feel like anybody who says they're watching a weird movie is somebody who doesn't watch a lot of movies. And so they watch something that is marginally... more complicated than they're accustomed to, and they're like, or they think there's something that doesn't make sense, which is, I'm sure, something we'll cover when we talk about Inherent Vice, but the idea of something that is a little bit unusual in terms of conventions, much more so than like truly weird. I mean, you know, everything doesn't have to be that's weird is not like a David Lynch movie. I mean, but for some reason, everybody who sees something, or many people who see something that is not completely familiar and easy to digest. They're like, that movie was weird. I'm like, no, the Lego movie was not that weird.
So. Every now and then you get something like Under the Skin, which many people loved, and yet would I could easily say, that's a weird movie.
That's a weird
for
movie.
Sure. Yeah. For sure. I agree with that. Yeah.
But basically, I agree with Todd, which is if you have a premise that is a little bit just one step over the convention line, it's considered a weird movie because it's just something that people don't really see.
Or you go five steps and you get Beyond the Black Rainbow.
I mean, then that's a crazy movie, or I didn't understand that movie.
Yeah, I was going to go Southland Tales.
Well, yeah, they had John Lovitz as like an assassin in that movie, so.
But then, dude, I didn't know that guy hasn't done anything since The Box, according to IMDb.
Yeah, what
yeah well, that doing? Movie bombed.
Yeah. But I support Richard Donner's decisions. And I like Southland Tales.
It was amusing.
It certainly grew on me. Like, I've watched it multiple times because I couldn't get it out of my head. It's like, yeah, he's doing stuff.
That guy must have really chosen not to do things, though, because M. Night Shyamalan got to make more and more movies. How does the guy who did Donnie Darko only get two after Darko?
M. Night Shyamalan has had one of the biggest movies ever when he's, you know, when Sixth Sense came out. Donnie Darko made like 40 cents and then just got a cult following, so you get more opportunities that way.
Fine, blah, blah, blah.
Well, the truth is that he made like four or five movies that were huge hits, so, you know, he can keep sort of making bad movies, whereas you can only make one good cult movie, and you know, and then after that, you know, he made two that I think are not very good, so and neither of them made money, so nobody's going to pay him to make more. And he also wrote Domino. That's important to notice.
I you know, I was talking about Domino the other day, and
isn't that one of your like go-to movies, Aaron?
I like Domino quite a bit, but I have the DVD and it's signed by Richard Kelly, so
nice.
Yeah, collector's item. That's what we call that. Okay, Abe, what's your question?
My question is, if you guys had to write a police character, like a detective, what kind of hairstyle would you give him? Josh Brolin's got that, you know,
that flat top.
Crop cut, yeah, flat top. But, you know, you've seen caps in these types of movies where they've got the suave comb-over kind of thing going. But Josh Brolin, I don't know. I'd probably ride the flat top, too, because it's more – you can do more with it.
Most times I get asked about what hair people should have in movies these days, it is Jai Courtney's faux hawk from Divergent. So
that is an awful haircut. A faux hawk would be, like, the cool detective, right? He just – the one that really doesn't care about his police captain.
But why not? Yeah.
Yeah.
I assume we just make him into McConaughey's character in True Detective.
Like, he's got a good hairstyle.
No, like the older version?
Yeah, which era?
Of course. Era. With the ponytail, huh?
Ponytail, scraggly-ish.
Yeah. The, like, or even just go further, the ponytail when you, like, don't even have any hair.
Like, it looks like he's bathed in, like, the beer that he's drinking at the interrogation.
It's good times. My dad just finished it. He liked it a lot. Dad review.
Thank you. Thank you for
that. Nice. Yeah, thank you for that.
We good? We good on that question, Abe?
You guys had some pretty solid answers.
Okay. Then that's how you play. No,
everybody.
All right. Moving on. Let's get to Out of Cookies.
DM.
Each week on Out Now, we have one main movie, or we have two movies this week that we talk about, but we always have other movies that I might have seen during the week that's out at 7 o'clock on Out Now Quickies.
DM.
All right. With that in mind, Abe, have you seen any other movies this week?
Not this week, but a couple weeks ago I caught, what is the Eddie Redmayne movie?
The Theory of Everything.
Theory of Everything. Yeah, I was going to say The Beautiful Theory of Everything. It was okay. I think that there was some nice cinematography and some nice writing here and there in terms of the emotional beats, but on the whole, it was okay.
Yeah, that's kind of where I felt. I mean, the performances are strong, yeah, but it's like, right. Yeah, it's an okay movie. Yeah. I really like the end credits. I don't like having to point that out, but the end credits are actually quite nice in that movie.
I don't ever remember the end credits.
It's just like going through the galaxy and then the score is all up. And
oh, okay.
Is,
right. Know,
I was just I was like, because that's the last thing I see in that movie before I walk out of it. So I was like, no, that was nice.
Spoiler alert.
That's right.
That's right.
He goes with Matthew McConaughey to discover.
Exactly. They go interstellar.
Yeah. Todd, have you seen any other movies this week?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, you know, I saw Paddington last week.
Yeah.
I wasn't as big a fan of it as everybody else seems to be. I mean, I've kind of, I guess, not having any children, or maybe not. I don't know if that has anything to do with it at all, but it's not, I didn't warm to it in the way that many other people seem to, but you know, it's surprisingly effective in certain moments. I think the problem for me is that without giving too much away, you know, it sort of combines this family, you know, feel good kind of stuff with like a sort of crimey kind of subplot. And I feel like when kids movies or these kind of like comedies that are supposed to be heartwarming decide they want to throw like plot machinery that usually involves some sort of criminal act or, you know, robbery or, you know, something like that, it kind of undermines the rest of it. And I definitely feel like that was the case with it. But at the same time, the special effects are pretty terrific. You know, I did the press day was last week for it, and they were talking about Ben Whishaw as the voice of Paddington. And it didn't quite dawn on me until they started talking about it, just kind of how perfect he is at having sort of a very sort of proper sort of accent that also managed to be really endearing and kind of adorable. And so I think that like gives it a lot of mileage that even, you know, the crime stuff wouldn't have otherwise.
All right. So Paddington, it's Harry and the Hendersons meets Heat. Got it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Great shootout scene, I'm hoping.
That's right. And you know, the thing is that you only see Paddington and Nicole Kidman in one scene. And so the whole movie is like just them coming together in that one diner scene. And then the rest of the movie is them completely separate. It's like a whole thing, you know. And I don't know if you when you watch it, you may not even see them in the same shot. So it's possible they weren't even there at the same time.
There's a lot
of
Moby on the score as well.
He just shows up like, do you want to get a cup of coffee?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Coming soon. Out now is commentary for Heat, all 3 hours. thank you for that. John, have you seen any other movies this week?
I caught two that are worth mentioning. One would be I finally saw Whiplash, and it's probably the best movie of the year that I've seen, at least. I don't know if it's my favorite movie of the year, but I think, like, objectively, it's probably the best movie I've seen this year, for sure.
You're a big Interstellar fan, correct?
Yeah, I would say, my quick short list is probably, at this point, Whiplash, Birdman, Boyhood, Interstellar.
I mean, those are all fantastic movies.
But yeah, Whiplash is just, like, the most affecting film I've seen this year. Like, you definitely, like, are kind of, like, sit with it for a second when the credits hit kind of thing. And just what it says about art, I think, is... And whether you want to push yourself or not, or if you need to or not, and to what level is very interesting to me. So definitely lived up to the hype. I would not be surprised if it got the best supporting actor
win for J.K. Simmons.
Yeah, exactly. And Miles Teller, always been a fan and continue to be a fan. And then
he needs a better haircut in the next Divergent movie, that's for sure. But I mean, after that, yeah.
Well, he has had no problem throwing that under the bus in interviews. And then I did see new to Netflix and probably worth people's time just because there's barely ever any new movies on Netflix. Is Frank?
Yep.
Oh. Hey.
And I saw that, and I mean, I enjoyed it. I wasn't like, it's not like a Pantheon movie for me, but I think it's definitely worth people checking out. It's got cool music. It's got kind of fascinating performance by Michael Fassbender, and it's kind of just a nice little quick indie movie you can pick up on Netflix right now.
Yeah, Abe and I were big fans of Frank.
Yeah, I think it was like one of my more surprising movies.
Hey, real quick, because we brought up top tens, kind of. Todd, did you have a final top 10 list assembled yet?
I sure did. My top 10, I only could ever really do it alphabetically because I always find it hard to go like, well, this one was number 7 and this one was number 8.
Fair enough.
Whatever.
That sounds fair. Yeah.
But so I do alphabetically, and it was Cheap Thrills, Ooh. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Grand Budapest Hotel, Ida, Inherent Vice, Journey to the West, the Stephen Chow movie, Lego movie.
See, Journey to the West has been on my Netflix queue for a while, and I've still yet to watch it, but I really want to because I like Stephen Chow quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Lego movie, Nightcrawler, The Raid 2, and Whiplash. So So those were my top 10. And it's funny because, you know, after I made the list, people were like, oh, you didn't put Selma on there and you didn't put Boyhood. I came very late to Boyhood, and I like Boyhood a lot, but it didn't resonate for me quite in the way that I feel like it might have had I seen it, you know, maybe earlier in the in its sort of ascendancy of the kind of recognition that it got. You know, I mean, I just came to it. I was like, I hear this is amazing, and it was very good. And like, I'm probably going to watch it again today, to be totally honest. But that and Selma is incredibly powerful, and I think it's unquestionably one of the best movies of the year. But I always sort of draw the distinction between like
best and favorite.
My top 10 is my favorite 10 movies of the year. And, you know, I whatever objective standard exists to determine what the best movies of the year are, they probably don't have that much to do with all the movies that I consider to be my favorite. Although I would be in agreement that Whiplash is about as well made a movie as you're going to see this or, you know, any other year.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, thanks for that.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't go. My quickie.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I saw Take Three this week. Taken Three. And that was a movie that I definitely saw in a theater.
Sounds like a hoot.
Like, we didn't talk about Taken Two on this podcast, but Jordan Grout and I believe we did, like, a bonus episode thing for it. And that was a movie where Liam Neeson instructed his very stupid daughter to throw grenades into public so she could better find out where he or
to be fair, she threw it up in the air.
Yeah, that makes the live grenadings better. Thank you for that.
Yeah, the strap.
Don't you spit at the altar of Liam Neeson's?
This movie is worse than that movie, and by a wide mile. It is awful, and I wasn't necessarily expecting much, but it's definitely proven to me that Luc Besson's protege, you know, one of his many, Olivia Megaton, who has, like, the best name in Hollywood, is, like, the worst of his protégés and one of the worst action directors working. Like, the movie is so, like, incomprehensible. There are, like, I believe there are, like, 3 car chases. There could be more or less. I don't remember, honestly, because the movie is so terrible. But there's one where it's, like, there's so much stuff going on and so many edits and close-up shots that I saw things spinning, but I'm not I felt like I saw 2 characters die again and again, but they were still around. So I'm like, okay. I'm not usually bad at this. If I can handle Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen, I feel like I can handle anything. Yet there are still some problems here. Because
it's almost like a John Woo movie, like when they use the stunt characters over and over again.
Yeah, but in John Woo movies, you know exactly what's happening because John Woo's a master of action.
This is true.
This is not the case in the
real world. I know
when
doves are gonna fly. Yeah.
It is awful. There are scenes of Liam Neeson where he's supposed to be like hectically running away from police, but because of, you know, Neeson being 62 years old, the editing's just like, we'll just rapidly cut around him, and he'll just kind of, like, hurriedly jog in places, and it'll seem like he's sprinting away.
He'll just pan out and he's, like, 2 feet away from the cops.
The senior citizen.
Oh, my God. Forrest Whitaker is in this movie. He plays a cop going after Neeson, who's been framed for murder, because it's, like, a bad retread of The Fugitive. And his character he's so bored as his character that he has both a chess piece and a rubber band in his hand to keep his hands occupied throughout the movie. There are so many things.
Say a chess piece?
A chess piece, yeah, he has a knight in his hand. And you know, represent, of course, the game of chess that he's playing.
I wasn't sure if you were talking about, like, a chest piece.
No, a chess piece. And a rubber band. He has 2 different things in his hands at all times so he can be like, I'm busy the whole time in this movie. That's my character. I haven't even talked about the plot of this movie yet.
I was going to ask if he's going to kill those guys from whatever country.
No.
I thought you were going to say there was no plot.
It's there, but it's really padded. There's a whole, like, he's like, oh my God. There's a whole segment of him, like, having to, like, his daughter, Maggie Grace, who's, like, I believe she's in, like, her early 30s. She's,
oh, yeah.
And she was, like, I believe in, like, early high school when she was, you know, 27 making the first movie. Now she's in college, of course, because that adds up. And there's like a whole segment of Liam Neeson like breaking into the school and like beating up security guards just so he can tell his daughter that he loves her before leaving and actually engaging with the plot. That's like 20 minutes of movie that has no bearing on anything except Liam Neeson beating up people that didn't.
They're showing how much of a father figure he is. He'll do anything to talk to his daughter. Yeah.
So, with all of that in mind, Taken 3 is a horrible movie. It is god-awful, and it made about $40 million at the box office this weekend. So, good on you, Taken 4. Here it comes.
Hopefully not directed by Olivia Megaton.
How do you put the 4 in Taken?
It'd be the T, I believe, right?
No, yeah, it would be the A.
It'd be the A. You're right. Yes, it would be the A. Yeah.
Torquing, yeah.
It would involve Ice Cube as well, so it'd be a Torque prequel, sequel, spin-off.
Because
Torque takes place
goodness.
In the future. That's the only way that movie makes sense. I believe Torque takes place in the future. Okay, so with all that said, that's not a cookie.
You mean Torque could take place in Tokyo?
It could.
We would only be so lucky.
Yeah, exactly.
I love Tokyo Drift. I'm not being...
I think you're talking to all fast.
You're talking to the right people. So
I'm just making sure. I don't want, you know.
So is there somebody who doesn't like Fast and Furious franchise? I don't know. I don't want to know that person.
Before 5 came out, Tokyo Drift was easily the best in the franchise.
Yeah, basically. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's Karate Kid with cars. That's the movie. I mean, it's a perfect franchise. For
it's the movie that got me back into the Fast and Furious series. Yeah. They did a good job here.
I can already say right now that Todd has insured himself another spot in this podcast because of his love for Tokyo Drift.
And if he brings Justin Lin along.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll see what I can do.
There you go.
Thanks.
When he's on break from True Detective.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on now. Let's get to trailer talk, where each week we talk about one of the newest movie trailers, what we thought of him, when it's coming out, and what have you. And this week we have an Ant-Man trailer, or Ant-Man. No one's going to call it that. Only I will. Ant-Man is, of course, the latest, or the next, not the next, because Ultron's coming next. It is the upcoming Marvel movie this July, formerly to be directed by Edgar Wright, now directed by the next best thing, Peyton Reed. And it stars Paul Rudd, Michael Douglas, Corey Stoll in bald mode, the perfect kind of Corey Stoll, and many other people. We've seen the trailer. John, I know you have a touch and go relationship with Marvel, it seems. what did you think of this trailer?
I will say when it first came out, I thought the trailer was very train wrecky looking. And then I just watched it right before now to kind of reapprise myself, and I was kind of like, okay, maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought. But the trailer definitely doesn't make me any more confident in this movie. Considering, like, I think 2014 was kind of like almost the year of the trailer, where a lot of big budget films like just had awesome trailers. One being the Avengers trailer, you know, another being Fast and Furious, and maybe of course the best of all, as Aaron and I have discussed, being Mad Max. So I thought this trailer, you know, I don't think it does anything wrong. It just didn't make it look like this awesome movie that like demands my viewing as a person who's been more about kind of the bigger Avengers or like the original Iron Man versus kind of some of the other iterations of the Marvel franchise, and I like Guardians 2 a lot. So, I mean, I'm still willing to think it could be okay, but tonally, it was kind of a weird trailer. Like, is it going to be funny? Is it going to be serious? Going to be a little bit of both, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, it didn't blow me away, at least.
Todd, what do you think of the Ant-Man trailer?
You know, I mean, generally speaking, I have difficulty investing too much judgment in trailers because, you know, you can see a great trailer for a bad movie, or you can see a bad trailer for a great movie. And, you know, as Guardians proved, you know, the expectation or the anticipation that something is so out of left field and bad that it can't work can be so roundly disproven by something that's so fun. You know, Ant-Man, I admit that I had a little trepidation once, not because I don't like Peyton Reed, but because Edgar Wright had spent so much time developing and putting so much of himself into it. And at the same time, I sort of understand that at the time that when he started it, you know, Marvel was not the Marvel that it is today. And so, like, they can't take it. Maybe they feel like they can't take the level of risk in putting something that seems so discordant to the rest of the Marvel universe they're creating. But I mean, like, what I saw looked okay. I was kind of surprised there was so little
action,
sort of real ant action kind of stuff. Like, I mean, you know, in terms of just demonstrating to audiences, like, what kind of stuff they'll get to see. I mean, you know, for better or for worse, you do get a sense of sort of the attitude of Guardians of the Galaxy, even from the earliest stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is kind of like, well, there's, you know, like one joke, and then there's like the sort of serious voiceover kind of stuff. But there, I didn't feel like there was anything where I was like, oh yeah, no, I really get how they're doing this or what they're doing. And I had actually read an interview where, I guess it was the Entertainment Weekly, piece from the set where they were talking about how they did all this sort of certain kind of photography to emphasize like the smaller size and things like that. They're not just creating like a giant ball. They're doing, you know, things that, that actually give it a interesting kind of dimensionality. And, you know, I'd be interested in seeing what all that stuff is. I'm still interested in seeing the movie, but the trailer, I guess for the sake of promoting what the movie is or isn't, did not do a particularly great job.
I just assume they have a lot of scenes taking place in backyards so they can reuse sets from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yeah, exactly. Yes! Exactly.
I
hope he ends up in a giant Cheerio. That's kind of like, it will get like automatic 3 stars just from having Ant-Man land in a giant Cheerio.
I can't tell you how many movies, regardless of if people get big or small, I just hope end up in giant Cheerios at some point anyway. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Dark Knight Rises.
Dark Knight Rises, yeah. If there was at some point, it's like, oh, Batman, now you want a Cheerio. Like, yeah. I would have been over the moon.
Yeah, that's how he got back to Gotham so quickly. He took the river that was white, and he sat in a raft that looked like a Cheerio.
With all that nonsense aside, Abe, what did you think of the Ant-Man trailer?
For the most part, I thought that it was okay. I'm glad that they had the Paul Rudd-isms. He was able to do some loose kind of bantery comedy. And I'm glad that Marvel is taking the direction in which it's going, because I basically just have ultimate trust in Marvel. I was sad to see that Edgar Wright dropped out, but I'm sure that they have to do things that make Marvel an enterprise that can continue,
brand, yeah.
Right, that can continue into the future. So that's understandable. So as little as they showed me in terms of plot, minus Michael Douglas and a daughter, I'm glad that this movie's coming out, and I'm excited to see it.
Yeah, I'm in basically the same realm as most of you guys here. I mean, it's surprisingly conventional as far as trailer goes. You get, you know, ominous voiceover, like one joke, and then like a flurry of moments to like give you a sense of what's going on. And I feel like that was, it seems like somewhat of a mistake, if anything. Like, I feel like Ant-Man, much like Guardians and some of the more obscure properties we've seen, are the kind of ones that need the extra boost to really get you interested in it. Because I don't know how much people are like, wow, Michael Douglas has a voiceover, that means I need to see this movie. Or they say, ooh, Paul Rudd's here, I like Paul Rudd, I should automatically see this. I don't know what that is exactly. Guardians, it's weirder, I guess, to an extent, because there's 4 of them, as opposed to just, and it's in space, as opposed to just like, hey, there's a guy that shrinks. But at the same time, it's like, does everyone know this character? Does everyone know who Ant-Man is? And is seeing one scene of him getting small and then a person riding a giant ant in the midst of, like, heavy backstory and, like, standard Marvel-type dialogue really going to do it for you? I don't know. If anything, for, you know, the first teaser, I would have liked to see just, like, an upgraded version of that Comic-Con teaser that we saw, like, years ago, of just, like, the proof-of-concept footage. I mean, that sells the character right there without even having any dialogue. But I mean, I'm still, it's not like we're not going to see Ant-Man. And so, I mean, that's the takeaway there. It's just like, yeah, this is a trailer. It's not the most overwhelming trailer, especially given a world where, you know, Ultron or Mad Max and a number of other things exist. Furious 7. Stan's like, yeah, all right, that's the first taste. So we'll see how this goes. I like the marketing via, like, posters and, like, the lead up to the trailer more than the actual trailer, I would say, with, like, the playing up the very small thing. Like, I like the poster that's just, like, a dot. That's like Ant-Man, and like the teaser trailer reveal, which was just like,
it was like
super small screen.
Right, exactly.
Like, that was a great like way to, you know, play up the joke on that one. I was enjoying that more than the like actual trailer. But, you know, it's fine. Like, it doesn't, you know, it's just a trailer. It's like, whatever. Yeah, you know, it exists. It's out there. Corey Stoll's bald.
I do like Corey Stoll being in it. Whoop whoop.
Yeah.
Friend of the show.
Friend of the show, Corey Stoll. Yeah.
What?
Well, yeah, we just say that. But it's an exclusive club.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, with that in mind, Ant-Man arrives in theaters July 17th, 2015. Be there or be small, I think.
And it comes out after Ultron?
Yeah, yeah. Ultron's the end of Phase 2. Ant-Man's the beginning of Phase 3.
Dun-dun-dun.
Exactly.
It's like graduation.
It's just like Vitamin C's graduation, you're right.
Yeah. When's the last time anyone heard that song?
Probably at a graduation, if I had to guess. That's a bold guess, but yeah.
Yeah. All right.
That was an amazing reference, by the way, I gotta say.
Thank you. That's what we do it out now.
We bring the current.
All right. I think with that out of the way, it's time to get to our first review for the film Inherent Vice.
Michael Z. Wolfman.
And Mickey Wolfman.
And Mickey Wolfman.
Has vanished.
So where would I find him?
He's technically Jewish, but wants to be a Nazi.
And a girl don't necessarily want to get into difficulties with those folks.
You got a spare picture I could borrow?
Mm-hmm. All right, so that should have been some of the trailer for Inherent Vice. Paul Thomas Anderson is back with an adaptation of the comic detective novel from Thomas Pynchon. Inherent Vice, set in 1970s L.A., the film features Joaquin Phoenix as a PI hired on a number of cases, which all seem to be connected in their own way, but it doesn't matter all that much compared to just watching Phoenix's perpetually stoned character make his way in and out of a story that finds him coming into contact with a variety of characters, including Renaissance cop Bigfoot Bjornsson. There's a lot of like letters in that one to say. A saxophone player, an old girlfriend, government spooks, and more. With all that in mind, start with Todd. Todd, what did you think of Inherent Vice?
Well, I put it on my top 10, so obviously I thought pretty well of it. You know, but what's really remarkable, you know, it's funny because I was thinking about, I revisited the movie. I watched it 3 times.
Wow.
Even before I had reviewed it, because I was just so sort of enamored with it. But, you know, everybody sort of compares the movie to Big Lebowski. But to me, it's more like Jackie Brown to me, in that it's like sort of a hangout movie, which is, I think, why a lot of people are not warming to it, because they don't maybe initially realize that, quite frankly, the plot in and of itself, like what he's doing, what he's trying to find out, is largely sort of irrelevant. I mean, like, it's more about sort of him and the characters and how they interact and relate to one another. And that's much more interesting and compelling than this mystery, which really, it's like the opposite of a normal mystery. It's like one man without the truth. Like, everybody else seems to know what's going on except for him. But I, you know, I find it to be like really sort of charming. And at the same time, it has this like sort of insidious undercurrent in terms of its portrait of, this sort of pivotal moment, I feel like, in American cultural history, where we went from sort of a very, optimistic, place of sort of hippie, idealism to sort of succumbing to like sort of corporate, culture, overtaking sort of every aspect of American life, and him sort of coming to that discovery incidentally while he's sort of investigating this incident and trying to figure out what happened to his ex-girlfriend, I think is a really interesting juxtaposition. And to me, that was kind of what I kept marveling at every time I would watch it. I was like, more little details about him and these other characters, and you know, how they interact and who they are, again, was always more interesting to me than you know, the mystery of who the Golden Fang was, because they kind of just tell us at one point.
Yeah.
And you know, he doesn't really do any like sleuthing. It's just like somebody's like, oh, that's a boat, and then it's like, oh, what does that mean? And then it just kind of you know, it's like the next time he has a conversation with somebody different, they go, oh yeah, no, that's what that means. And so he's not, he is actually much more skilled, I would say, than like Jeff Bridges Lebowski, in that, you know, he can stand up for himself. He can figure things out. Like, you talk about the pancake scene, you know, he has a sort of verbal showdown with Bigfoot. And instead of sort of just being this like dumb guy who kind of obliviously goes past it, he sort of he comes back at him with something that's sort of an equal rejoinder to Bigfoot sort of insults and stuff like that. And you're kind of like, wow, this guy actually can do his job and he knows what he's doing. But but again, sort of that juxtaposition between you know, a mystery that doesn't necessarily have an easy or satisfying resolution, with a story about people who, you know, sort of go in and out of lucidity anyway. I think it kind of complements one another and provides an interesting counterpoint at the same time.
With that in mind, did you read the book, Todd?
No, I did not. I don't know how to read, so. Okay.
John, I believe you have read the book, correct?
No.
Really?
You read a synopsis of the book.
I just wondered, you said you read the book.
Oh, no, I just said that Pynchon's one of my favorite authors, but I actually have not read the book.
Okay, well, with that in mind, what'd you think of the film?
I get... I guess I think it's better. It's more good than not good, but it wasn't quite as awesome as I hoped. I think it's probably the least awesome PTA, or you know, the least awesome Anderson movie. I don't know. It's kind of interesting that as him being a director, I think is like the weakest part of this movie, maybe, which is something I would never say about any of his other movies. But I actually think the actors and especially the writing, and kind of especially the writing that you can tell is kind of coming from a novel, are kind of the most compelling parts of this. Instead of like, I mean, The Master was kind of like the most pretty movie ever. And I wasn't kind of like as astounded by the imagery for this movie. And I thought it was kind of slow here and there. But that said, it's just got too many fun characters, too many absurd meanderings to like not be entertaining here and there as well. So it's not like a world beater for me, but it's also, I think, was a pretty entertaining watch as well. And kind of just kind of, and especially fun living out in LA and kind of like seeing the world that they build a little bit there too. And I thought Todd actually cribbed it really well. If you're like going to defend the movie, I thought he did like kind of an excellent job of that, where it's like, maybe it's not supposed to have all the forward momentum maybe you're used to in a movie or something like that. But even understanding that, I definitely thought you could have maybe lopped off a little bit of its running time and made it a little tighter. And maybe it's not meant to be that way, but I think it hurt it a little bit for me just because there was some slowness in parts. And but then again, it's going to give us some of the better characters, especially Joaquin Phoenix's Doc and Josh Brolin's just a hoot as Big Orn. So, I mean, there's some amazing characters. Martin Short shows up and kind of steals the show for a little bit. So it's definitely a fun, it's somehow like both a fun romp and sometimes confounding and boring at other junctions for me.
Have you seen it more than once, just out of curiosity?
No. I thought it was interesting that you kind of cribbed it in that way of what would you, knowing what you know after you watch it once, you'd definitely watch it differently a second time if you're not searching for answers, for sure.
Yeah, and you know, I was going to say, you know, my sort of Jackie Brown comparison, I say for my own sake, you know, the first time I saw Jackie Brown, and yet I'm telling you, I'm a person who saw Pulp Fiction 5 times the first week that it came out. I was like the biggest Tarantino fan like in the world when Jackie Brown came out, and I was not a huge fan of that. And when after I watched it, you know, a few times, I mean, now it's like, I think, a masterpiece. And just watching it, I like luxuriate in the details of the characters and everything. And I feel like, you know, somebody, I think Jordan Hoffman for Screen Crush actually wrote a piece, or maybe not for Screen Crush, but he wrote a piece last week about, do some movies deserve multiple viewings for you to sort of get them? And I wonder, you may or may not feel that way, but I think it's kind of interesting that it's a movie to me that I feel like only sort of appreciates in sort of enjoyment when you watch it more than once, and you don't have that kind of, oh, you know, what's going to happen next kind of feeling the whole time.
People on the show know that I love Jackie Brown. That is one of my favorite movies, if not my favorite movie on a given day ever. So it is a very apt comparison, I feel, because it does have the vibe of a hangout movie to an extent, where it's much more interested in showing you these characters and letting them interact with each other and just kind of having also a plot in the background to an extent. And this movie, Jackie Brown's more of like, here's an hour of just letting us get used to these people, and then also here's a plot. Inherent Vice is just like, that's the whole thing through, of just like, let's just get used to these characters. Also, you know, yeah, go here, Doc, do that. Like, it's that throughout the movie. And I really enjoyed it the first time around. I've seen it twice at this point. And I hate having to say something like, you really got to see it another time to really appreciate it. And I'm not going to say that now, because that's not necessarily fair. But at the same time, there is more to glean from it as you watch it. It's a movie that definitely benefits from rewatching. I feel like there's a way to enjoy this movie the first time around, and it can likely get better for you the second time around. But regardless, I did, you know, really enjoy this movie the first time around. All of that in mind, I mean, the actors are terrific here. I loved Joaquin Phoenix in this role, who's so, and like I thought her, he was in her, he was very likable. This movie, he's somehow even more likable, and then, like, it was just the way he interacts with people, regardless of his nature, his the state that he's in, which is perpetually stoned or whatnot. I loved watching this character interact with so many different people. Then you have this entire supporting cast, and I've talked about last week how I think Josh Brolin is absolutely terrific in this film, as Renaissance cop Bigfoot Bjornsson. So something I liked about early PTA is that Robert Altman was like a big kind of influence on the way he did his work, and I feel like that was maybe gone in the last couple films just because the kind of sprawling nature they had, and much more in like Kubrickian territory with There Will Be Blood for sure. Here it's kind of back where people are just overlapping with dialogue and whatnot, and like there's a whole scene of like of Joaquin Phoenix and Josh Brolin where they're dealing with each other for like the first time in the film, and then like Benicio del Toro steps in. And it doesn't even feel like it's script. It just feels as if like Benicio del Toro just decided to walk into a scene and start interacting, and it just felt very natural. And that's what I get in a lot of this movie. Add to that, yeah, there's this kind of layer of drama that I appreciated. There's a lot of other elements that involve kind of where the story takes us with Doc and his ex-girlfriend and the implications happening based on the times that these characters are living in. Like, it just, all this movie, I was just a really big fan of. I just really liked, I liked being in this world, which is something that I'm very happy to say in a movie where, like, the story is not the thing that I'm promoting the most. It's just, I like this world that's being set up here, and whether that's been heavily detailed in Pynchon's novel, or Paul Thomas Anderson just did a very good job of visualizing what he read in the book that he adapted, like, I really enjoyed what I was seeing here. Well, that said, Abe, what did you think of the film?
I basically don't have that much else in terms of opinion from what you guys have said. I thought that it was a pretty good companion piece as well, but it does meander from here to there. I think the most bored I got was like the beginning of – or the end of the second act moving into the third act, and I was just thinking, wow, that's only when I started feeling the length of it. But you're right, Aaron, that I think that it is one of those movies where – I probably would want to watch it a second time, and that's not a slight in any way. It's kind of more of a – the meandering part of it is just that there was a lot of cases and a lot of mystery, like what Todd was saying. And at a certain point, I was just thinking to myself, all right, well, I'm just going to enjoy all these people that I'm seeing on the screen, because there's a lot of screen chemistry with a lot of these actors. And again, Josh Brolin, you guys have said it, and I just want to reemphasize that he is terrific in this movie. He's got a frozen banana eating scene, which lasts for quite a while. And I just, my friend and I were like laughing so hard, people were starting to look at us. And then he's also got a doper's ESP scene with Joaquin Phoenix toward the end, which was hilarious as well. So I'm just like, why did this happen? Joaquin Phoenix, I agree that he's very, very charming in this movie. You're rooting for Doc, and even though he's stoned most of the time, there's bits and pieces here and there which shows his humanity in terms of, you know, instead of wanting money for drugs, he just wants somebody to go free and go back to some of the people that care for him. It is a strange movie. It is kind of a movie that you might not like because you might not sense a strong plot line throughout it. But for the most part, I found it very enjoyable, very funny, and I also would think that on second viewing, I might glean some more, but it certainly is not going to be for everybody, especially if this kind of goes back to Aaron's question earlier, which is, you know, what do you think is a strange movie, or what would you call a weird movie? I wouldn't call this one a weird movie, but it's not for everybody.
Would you say it's more, and I'll ask this to John specifically too, or even – and. All of you guys, opening it up to the panel.
Thanks.
Would you guys say this is more or less accessible than The Master?
I think it's more accessible than The Master.
Oh, definitely more accessible than Master. I mean, I think The Master might be one of the top, like, 10 most, like, I couldn't process my feelings at all after The Master movies, like, ever. Like, this movie, at least you've got kind of that comedy throw line so that you can kind of keep going with it even if it doesn't make sense to you or is a little weird. And I think that helps, whereas The Master, I think, I don't know. There are not many people I could ultimately, like, recommend The Master to. You could still recommend this to people and they would enjoy parts of it, you know?
It's funny you say that because I when I went home over the holidays, I had a screener, and I was talking to my dad about it, and he's like, "What's this movie? This Joaquin Phoenix movie?" I'm like, "I don't think you would like it." And he's like, "What is it?" And I'm like, "Well, it's like sort of a mystery." He's like, "Well, I love mysteries." And I'm like, "Yeah, but it's not exactly." And I was like, "But it takes place during the, you know, the early 70s in Southern California." He's like, "Oh, that's my era." And I was like, "All right, then watch it." Like, I mean, like, I would never try to actively discourage somebody. I didn't think that my dad would like it. But I do want to sort of say before we move on, you know, the other night, just randomly, I decided to rewatch Chinatown. Just because I'd been wanting to watch it for like 6 months and I didn't have anything to do. And I sat down and it kind of surprised me how many similarities I see between, like, if you combine Chinatown and Jackie Brown, I feel like you would get Inherent Vice. Like, in that when you watch Chinatown, you're sitting there and you're like, this isn't about a character having like this very specific kind of arc or anything. It's not like necessarily about his journey. It's, you know, it's about this world that he lives in and about sort of reevaluating what's going on with him and around him from one scene to the next. And I was kind of really surprised because that movie too is also sort of about a moment in history in, you know, in California, and about how there is this creeping corruption that begins to infect culture and, you know, in society. And, you know, and at the same time, like, it's about a person who sort of, in spite of his own sort of self-absorption, be it because of, in this case, drugs, or, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal's case, because of sort of his ambition, his personal ambitions, like, he becomes sort of emotionally invested in helping this person, you know, and how that goes right and goes wrong. And I think that, you know, if you like Chinatown, I think that it might be a good primer for your attitude going in to watch Inherent Vice. You know, I mean, like I said, I can't guarantee, as Aaron said, you know, that you will necessarily like the movie better if you watch it multiple times. But, you know, sort of having an understanding of what the attitude and tone of it is, you know, and understanding that's as important, if not more important than like the plot machinery, I think will amplify sort of your appreciation and enjoyment for the movie.
And then just to add into that, there's just knowing that this is a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, you know that there's probably a lot of subtle messages that he's trying to put into the movie as well. And if you watch Magnolia or if you watch any of his other works, there's a lot of, you know, verses from the Bible that he puts in and whatever else. So I know that there's probably more to it than meets the eye, which is why I'm eager to watch it a second time. And the camera work in here is really, really well done too. I mean, there's subtle things that Paul Thomas Anderson does. Benicio del Toro and Joaquin Phoenix are having a conversation at this lunch spot, and the camera just keeps pushing into their faces as the conversation becomes increasingly more secret. You know, there's a lot of things that he's doing, so it's not as though it's just a bunch of friends being on the screen. There's still a film.
There's a level of professionalism.
Yeah,
here,
exactly.
For sure. And I mean, from a technical perspective, like a filmmaking perspective, yes. I mean, the way he puts scenes together, John, I can understand what you're saying. Where compared to something like The Master, There Will Be Blood, which are as much visual experiences as they are, you know, dialogue-driven features, which they're not really. The Master more so than There Will Be Blood. I mean, that's, you know, 20 minutes of nothing for the first 20 minutes. So, but I mean, this movie is definitely more focused on like people interacting with one another, which is very much in line with kind of earlier PTA work with Sydney and Boogie Nights. This film, yes, while it has it's a break from the uber serious PTA that we've been seeing and back to kind of more comic rhythm form. It does, you know, it's a very good looking film. It has a great soundtrack once again with Johnny Greenwood doing the score, assisted by a number of very, very cool tracks. I really like the soundtrack quite a bit.
I was going to say, I just want to add in terms of the visual look. I mean, it looks like a movie that was made in 1970.
Yes.
And that to me is what's so impressive. I mean, you're talking about like the scenes where he's doing a lot of like pushing in and things like that. But, you know, the scene that you mentioned earlier where Joaquin and Josh Brolin go in and they have that first exchange, mm-hmm. and there's these sort of like low angles shots of Bigfoot talking. And it has that sort of like washed out look that you watched like Freebie and the Bean, or you watched, you know, whatever. I mean, like when you watch movies in the 70s, they have this kind of like flat, sort of unassuming. It's not a it's definitely indisputably proficient, but at the same time, like, it's unshowy. And, you know, I feel like what's really remarkable if you watch the progression of Paul Thomas Anderson's directing is that he's much less showy than he used to be, and yet he's no less effective. And, you know, when you watch this, and even The Master, I mean, he worked with a different cinematographer than he ever had on The Master than he did on any of his other movies. He was reunited with Robert Elswit for this one. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I think The Master is a stunningly beautiful movie, and yet it's so economic when in its choices. And this movie is the same way. I mean, you think about all these shots that, like, I mean, there are sequences in this movie that have, like, extended tracking shots and things like that. But honestly, off the top of my head, I couldn't even tell you one because I'm so absorbed in the storytelling that he's doing as a result of that camera work, as opposed to, like, when you think about, like, the shots in Magnolia where they're going down the street and they're cutting in on this and they're, you know, doing all this kind of stuff, which is not to say that stuff isn't effective. It's just a matter of it being more of a flourish as opposed to, like, an integral part of the actual storytelling.
Yeah, you certainly, like, obviously, like, with Boogie Nights specifically, Scorsese, he's just been, like, a huge influence that people kind of like to name with PTA, and that seems apparent there. And Scorsese, he can be a showy director at times, and that seems that, I mean, that that has that early influence there. This movie, yeah, I completely agree, where it's, there's a lot less going on in terms of kind of how slick PTA can be in a film, but there's certainly plenty going on within the frame because of how he's choosing to make his film, how to assemble the film. And
I don't know. I guess I do miss showy PTA. I guess I became a big PTA fan because of There Will Be Blood. I mean, I enjoyed Magnolia and Boogie Nights, you know, and Punch Drunk Love beforehand, but, like, you know, There Will Be Blood was the jam, and then, like, I mean, in The Master, like, all my excitement centering around that were, like, these crazy shots that he had there, and so it's just kind of, it wasn't jarring, that's not the right word, but it's just kind of weird to, like, watch a movie of his now where, like, the directing didn't really matter to me, and this will be an unpopular opinion alert, but it's, like, almost would have, like, I kind of came out of that movie and I was like, that movie actually, like, made me think that the book was, like, would be awesome. Like, more awesome than the movie. Cause, like, I love Joanna Newsom's part because that was she was used as a device to use more of the Pinchon language, in the narration. And I almost, like, wondered if I would enjoy the movie more if, like, I just hired all these people to do, like, a table read of the book.
Absolutely. I don't know if you guys know this, but the way that he adapted this was that he literally adapted the entire novel,
yep,
line for line, start to finish.
And then he started hacking away at it.
And I think that's pretty brilliant. I mean, like, it's one of those things where you, like, sort of dream of filmmakers doing that, because usually it turns out to be, like, they bring somebody in and they just chop it up and they go, oh, well, this story is not going to work. Let's cut that out. Like, he was reductive in his editing efforts. And I think that it, like, gets at the essence of what his movie is communicating. I mean, I think about the scene between Owen Wilson and Joaquin at the pier. And Owen Wilson is telling him this story about, like, session musicians in his band. And you realize that, like, this is not important at all. I mean, like, it's not important to his characters. You're not really, like, learning anything, except that these are two stoned people who just feel compelled to include this information because they're stoned. And, like, to me, there's something, like, really charming about that. I don't know, like, it was one of those things, because I know the first time I was like, why are they telling me this? What does this have to do with anything? And I was like, oh, it has nothing to do with anything. And yet I found it to be, you know, really fun to watch, because it says, because even though it's not, like, revealing so much of, like, their history in a meaningful way, it reveals a lot about their characters in terms of what their priorities are and who they are and what they're, you know.
And that's something that that I want to tag on too, is just, it's not so much that it's trying to throw red herrings at you. It's actually just people that are having conversations, and they're not trying to do anything tricky with the storyline per se. It's just that this happened, and it might seem out of place, but it's actually, like what you had described, it's just a bunch of stoners having discussions.
The word I'm hearing is that the Department of Justice is trying to broker a Vegas deal for him.
Doesn't compute.
Say again. Vegas Wolfen. FBI stuff. They need somebody else on the strip who's not Italian. You dig? Like Howard Hughes when he bought the Desert Inn. Howard Hughes was Italian.
Which is right. All that it really is. There's no, like, I should really pay hard attention to this. There are some things like that from here to there, just for you to understand the story in terms of, you know, there's like there's a scene where Josh Brolin is trying to make Joaquin Phoenix choose one card, and that in itself is funny. But when he reads the card, I was like, I don't know who this person is. Like, I don't know who he's being asked to investigate right now.
Well, but it's hard to say too, like how much it's stoner and how much, like I haven't look to see how dense of a Pinchon this one is, but like his books are like generally massive tomes of like non sequitur parts and stuff like that. So it's kind of,
I mean, you guys have brought up the fact that you think it meanders and it is a 2.5 hour movie, so I feel like it probably does a pretty good job of representing the novel quite well.
Yeah.
Probably.
It's kind of fun. I think one of the more fun parts about the movie is just who PTA was able to get to kind of like tag in. I mean, nobody other than Joaquin really has, like, a super big part, and yet we get to see Owen Wilson
There's plenty of Bigfoot. There's plenty of there's more Benicio than I remembered when I saw it the second time, actually.
Yeah, but it's fun that, like, yeah, he comes in, and then Reese Witherspoon has a really fun, awful part.
Even Jenna Malone is not a throwaway character, you know, like, yeah. I mean, again, the first 40 minutes of the movie had me laughing so hard. And there's great stuff with Benicio del Toro. And it's like, why is he dressed like a sailor? And then Josh Brolin's like, yeah, this isn't marine law. And I was like, oh, ha-ha, good job by you guys.
I could add pirates to that if you like. All right, we've been talking about this. Let's move on now. We have two movies to review here. So with that in mind, Inherent Vice, when would you guys recommend seeing this movie? I'll start with Todd.
I mean, now?
Yeah, I mean, it's on your top 10, so obviously.
Yeah. I love it. You know, it's one that, you know, like I said, I had the screener. I watched it. I've seen it twice in theaters and once on the screener, and I definitely, you know, I want to go see it. It's, I'm sure, showing in some places in 70mm, which I would wholeheartedly recommend seeing it because of the you know, the picture quality and everything, but see it as soon as possible. I love it.
John?
I think I'm still very positive on the movie, but I think people can, I don't think it's a movie that demands people go see it in theater versus maybe some of the other movies I've seen in recent times. So I suppose I would say, rent it, but you know, feel free to like VOD rent it. So it's not like a $1 rental recommendation. You know, it's better than just paying a dollar.
I'd say just watch in theaters.
Yeah, I'm right there with that. I mean, I fully support what Todd said, actually, too. Yeah, if you can see it in 70mm or just like on a film projector in general, that'd be awesome. I don't know how easy that is to come by these days, but certainly, yeah, one that I wholeheartedly recommend. It was on my top 10 list as well, and because I really love the movie. Okay, with all that in mind, I know, John, you have to take off now. Because you just haven't seen Selma, and because we don't want you on the show anymore.
I know.
John.
So John, where can people find more of your work online?
You can find my writing, especially if you're in the LA area, more than ever now. I think this might be the first time I'm on the pod since I got my new gig. It's beverlypress.com, and we cover Hollywood, West Hollywood, Miracle Mile, Hancock Park. So kind of that weird central region of LA where, you know, away from downtown, away from the coast, but kind of in Hollywood there. So if you're into news, go to there. Woo!
Woo!
And for all your football updates on Twitter.
I was going to say, yeah, for sporadic retweets of NBA people and for screaming at the Iowa Hawkeye basketball and football teams, I'm at Sir John Van Dyke.
Okay. Well, great, John. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So that's that. Now let's move on. Let's get to our next film review, and this will be for Selma.
There are 70 million people watching. These pictures are going around the world.
We must make a massive demonstration.
Why
white, black, and otherwise. Come to Selma.
I heard about the attack of innocent people. I couldn't just stand by.
Looks like an army out there.
This revolution goes on and on. This revolution goes on and on.
My eyes have seen the glory. 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 Hallelujah.
What happens when a man stands up, says enough is enough?
All right, so that should have been some of the trailer for Selma. We now have a major theatrical feature about Martin Luther King Jr. Luckily, Selma does not want us to focus on all of MLK's life, but just instead a specific point, the 1965 marches from Selma to Montgomery. Director Ava DuVernay puts David Oyelowo, two great names right there to say, into the shoes of Dr. King as we watch a man deal with being an influential figure as well as just a human with some grand ideas as he works to secure equal voting rights. With all of that in mind, start off Abe this time. Abe, what'd you think of Selma?
Abe? What? I thought Selma was a really well-done movie. I think that one of the things that you had mentioned, it's not specifically centered around Martin Luther King Jr. It for the most part, it is, but there's a lot of other characters that are in this movie that they do take the time to explore, such as President Lyndon Johnson, and Tom Wilkinson does a great job. I think he has one of the more dramatic roles with Tim Roth toward the end of the movie, and that part just made me fired up. I was like, wow, this is incredible. Like, this is exactly, I'm pretty sure these are the conversations that happened behind closed doors. The other thing I liked about it is that it kind of didn't make Martin Luther King, it made him a human being, let's say. It's there were some questions about infidelity and whatever else, and I know that wasn't really popular at the time, and I think that there were some releases of some Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis tapes, and she had said that, you know, he's got some philanderings going on, and people were like, well, that's not true. And they did bring that sort of to light here. And they're also talking about some of his vices, which is, I didn't know that Martin Luther King was a smoker, right? So, but for the most part, it is very competent filmmaking. Ava, I don't know how many films she's made, but this seems like a very competent project. And one of the things I really, really liked about it is that it's not so much throwing it in the face of like, well, this is one particular view of things. It's more of an assembly of characters and assembly of thoughts, and it wasn't easy. There were some larger, big picture implications of it, meaning, you know, I'm not going to march on Selma because it's exactly what people would have thought for us to do. It's because it plays into a larger picture for us to get equal rights and equality and whatever else. And I know that people are going to be hurt by this, but we have to try it because we need to be heard by the federal government and by these two states out here out there in the South. So on the whole, it's more complex than it really was, and I'm glad that they were able to delve into it. One of the things that I also would have been more interested in too is just how much the FBI was either for or against Martin Luther King Jr. It seems like J. Edgar Hoover wasn't really on the same page, and I would have been interested to see if there was some sort of calamity here and there. And then just reading the post things at the end where they're describing where some of these people went, there was one character which I was very saddened to read about. It was just the one of the volunteers, and she was murdered on the way back driving to Selma, and that was just very unfortunate. And again, this is not something that people should take lightly. It's very serious. These are real accounts. And in terms of being apt for today, yes, it is apt for today. And I think that it's just, I don't know, I feel as though it's not something that you have to force people to watch, but if you watched it, good on you. And I think that it's doing very well. So it's doing probably some good business. But in terms of the morals that it's putting across, I do think people should take a look at it.
Todd.
You know what? I mean, I loved it. I didn't put it on my top 10. I think just because there were other things that I sort of maybe more conspicuously loved more quickly. But Ava DuVernay does a really amazing job of like chronicling this event in history, this sort of like really important moment, in a way that I feel like is, you know, very human and identifiable and not rhetorical in any way. You know, I feel like you're not watching, you know, the beats of history being sort of read to you or dictated as much as you are sort of experiencing the idea that Martin Luther King, although he was obviously sort of in comparison to, say, other black leaders of the time, like Malcolm X, you know, he was less incendiary. He was not a person who was afraid to strategically put himself in harm's way in order to try to accomplish his goals, which is to say that, you know, I was reading the review that the guys on Film Drunk wrote, and they were sort of observing, I think very astutely, that you know, it's easy for a movie about people marching or, you know, doing a protest to be sort of locked arm in arm and it be the sort of, you know, noble, beautiful kind of thing. And what's great is that this movie sort of has that, but it also has the idea that these guys know they're putting themselves in harm's way, because what happens is when the media reports on it, then, you know, people who are both black and white are going to have to sort of bear witness to the violence that these people endure in the name of earning equal rights. And, you know, and I think that's what makes it an especially prescient movie, is that, you know, like, you know, when all this stuff happened in Ferguson and with Eric Garner in New York, I think there is a feeling, I mean, as I was like, I'm as a white male, I was like, for me to feel completely helpless in these situations, I can't imagine how a person who lives in those cities who has to deal with that would feel. And it's kind of interesting to me that we think about the way protests are now, and we're like, there is a sort of media attitude that they are like disruptive and problematic. Whereas, you know, then they were disruptive and problematic, but they got results, and they changed things, and they forced the hands of people like LBJ and other people to make the changes that you know, earned people the kind of equality that they deserve. And all this sort of, you know, sort of political stuff notwithstanding, what the movie does is it doesn't put that on the forefront. It just makes it about these human people and the choices that they make to accomplish their goals. And it becomes a really powerful story just by itself. And then it gains this additional resonance and meaning with the history underlying in all those decisions.
It's hard to keep repeating the same thing, so I want to try not to, just because, I mean, I agree with everything you guys are saying. And I certainly really love this film as well. It was on my top 10 list. And I mean, just coming at it from like a basic level, I think the movie's so well made from just a directorial standpoint, given the amount of times you had to put this whole thing together. The acting across the board is pretty ranges from fantastic to pretty great. David Oyelowo does a very good job as Martin Luther King, who, and I described this last week on the podcast, it's not that you don't look at David Oyelowo and think, oh man, this guy looks like Dr. King, you should play him, but it's just he's able to capture the kind of essence of that personality, of who King was, where, you know, it's not necessarily like a spot-on impression, but you feel like he studied this role in the right ways to get the little quirks and nuances and details about who this man is and how he, you know, presents himself and how he's still, you know, human in all of this. Like, it's one thing to, you know, portray someone that has such a grand stature in American history, but it's another thing to really kind of capture this person as a human being. And I think Oyelowo does that well. I mean, along with, you know, how the screenplay serves him in all of this, I think that does a great job there. I can say the same about Tom Wilkinson. I think he does a very good job as LBJ. And even, you know, the smaller roles, like Carmen Ejogo? That's hard to say. As Coretta King. Just, there's things about these performances that make the film, you know, it makes it work. It makes it not feel like a history lesson. Like, I think that's kind of the trepidation some people might have of a film like Selma, where it's just like, oh, I got to see a Martin Luther King film. I'm just going to learn stuff and not be entertained by it. It's not about it whether it's, you know, entertaining or not. I do think it is an entertaining film, but I think it does, the way it approaches its storytelling, yes, there are dramatic moments and there are things that can make people emotional, or there are things that reflect history in a way where it can be upsetting or frustrating or not even the most, like, I need to keep watching this type of feeling. It's more of like, yeah, this stuff like this happened and it's being captured on film. But I do think Ava DuVernay, I think she does a very good job of kind of assembling this picture, making it work as a piece of film that, you know, you can watch and reflect upon, but also find, you know, things about it that make it one that seems like, hey, this was worth watching in a theater. I'm glad I did this. To go with that, yes, I mean, the movie does have a lot of timely aspects to it, given what's being tackled in this film and what we're seeing in, you know, today's state of affairs in America, which we've discussed already. But I mean, what I really like getting back down to kind of the human elements. Like, this movie, it reminds me a lot of Lincoln.
I think, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, and you know, due to, you know, the way it kind of takes a slice of history as opposed to all of Lincoln's life. But even in just the way it kind of treats the characters, where Daniel Day-Lewis, yes, he's playing Abraham Lincoln, another character, another American historical character that, you know, has a level of grandeur to him when you say the name Lincoln. But the way he kind of made that work, it functioned as portraying him as a human being that, you know, isn't always necessarily right, or, you know, doesn't have to make grand speeches every 10 seconds. He's just, you know, a person that's talking. And what's funny is that the first scene of that movie features David Oyelowo as a Union soldier who's discussing, right, just discussing, you know, terms about the kind of state of living and the pay rates for the black soldiers and they are in the, you know, fighting in the Civil War. And what I like about that scene, it's not going to lead into the whole, hey, he finishes the Gettysburg Address speech at the end. That's, you know, whatever. It's the way they talk to each other in that scene where Lincoln is basically bullshitting them. He's kind of, they're like, David Oyelowo is trying to bring up something and Lincoln can't necessarily do anything about it. So they just kind of get into a random conversation. And there's a lot of that in this movie. There's obviously, you know, there's the big pivotal stuff that happens and whatnot, but there's a lot of just kind of scenes where people can't necessarily do something about something and they just instead have another conversation. And I like those. I like a lot of those movies. I like the beginning of this movie where Martin Luther King, he's about to accept his Nobel Prize and he's like practicing his speech and he's trying to get his tie ready. And
Ascot.
And Coretta King comes over and she just kind of helps him out and they have like casual conversation. It's a movie where you're not watching just, you know, a History Channel documentary about a subject. You're watching people interact with each other. Even the scene with like Martin Luther, Malcolm X is played, where you're not saying like, "Look, it's Malcolm X. Let me repeat all of his ideals." It's no, like, let's have a conversation. And this movie is full of all of that. And it's things like that that make this movie just really stand out to me.
And again, there's just conversations, and they're just humans on the screen. It's not as though it's not with rose-colored glasses, because there were arguments within the community or within the group itself. Like, I didn't know that the SNCC guys, they, you know, half of them were going to be out of it, and then only John Lewis is going to be a part of it. Also, John Lewis, the cast of John Lewis, the guy looks exactly like young John Lewis.
Yeah.
They also did a really good casting on the other stuff. You mentioned all these small other side characters. There's an FBI agent played by or just a government worker played by Alessandro Nivola, and he's very good too, and people don't really recognize him, but he's Pollux Troy from Face Off. Yeah,
Jurassic Park. He's in The Most Violent Year actually as well. He's a role.
Is he?
There,
okay. Yeah, but there's all these small roles that are done very well. Giovanni Ribisi does a very good job as an aide to LBJ. Again, Tim Roth is very good.
I enjoyed the small amount of Oprah in this movie as opposed to the butler, where I thought like the butler.
I'm glad I didn't watch the butler, so I have no comparison.
It's not that I like it because I liked the butler. I didn't love the butler, but I mean it. That's a movie where it felt like once Oprah joined, they made her role bigger. This movie just feels like she's in it just enough.
Yeah.
Wonder what old Don will say when I tell him one of his gals down here stirring a fuss.
I ain't stirring no fuss. I'm just here trying to register to vote.
Recite the Constitution's preamble. You know what a preamble is?
We the people of the United States. In order to form a more perfect union.
How many county judges in Alabama?
67.
Name them.
Given what you said, do you see what I'm saying, Todd? Do you know what I'm trying to say with that?
Yeah, I think so.
Because she's like, she has a, she's representing a certain figure and like what's going on at the time and whatnot. And I feel like in a lesser movie, it's like, well, we got Oprah. We got to play up that presence, and they don't do that here, which I appreciated.
Yeah.
No, I think they do. They populate it with the characters. They populate it with the people from history, but they don't overstate their presences. I mean, you know, like it was interesting. They have that moment with Mahalia Jackson where Martin Luther King calls her in the middle of the night, and you kind of go, "Well, did that really happen?" And then they do a title on the screen that says like, we have a transcript from, you know, an FBI wiretap that says that he did call. Now, do we know that she sang him a song? We don't know, but we know that there was that call was made. And but the thing is, like, when that call happens, he calls her and we don't know who that is. And she sings. And, you know, and I think that, like, the movie does a really great job of not name dropping. And I think that's what you're getting at is that, like, you know, Oprah plays a character who was a person who was, you know, did the things that that character did. But they don't make her like a martyr in the middle of the movie where it's like, well, this is the most important thing. Like, you see a young man, you know, who's fleeing a riot, a police riot, or a riot against protesters, you know, run into a restaurant, he gets shot. And, you know, unless you really know that history, they don't go, well, that's right, you know, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. They don't give, they don't, you know, overemphasize the names of the people. I mean, I think, like, you know, you mentioned Malcolm X. Like, I think there's only, if I'm not mistaken, there's only, I've only seen it once and it was a little while ago, but it's like, there's only a scene where he's like walking up to talk to them. It's not even like they have like, well, we're going to have this, like, you know, come to Jesus moment where they have this like huge argument showdown. It's like, oh, well, you know, this is how we handle this guy as a partner in our goals.
Yeah, it's one scene and it's not even with King. It's with Coretta King,
with his wife.
Yeah.
And it's one, and like it's done in a really good way. I really enjoyed that scene because it's able to state who Malcolm X is without directly doing it, and then the next time you hear of him, he's been assassinated. Like that, like it's not trying to show. It's like it's not going on any tangents. It's not going out of its way to really fill you in on all the details you need. It's giving you the essence of one scene, one interaction, and then it moves.
And
on.
Not only that, I mean, what it also adds is it also adds that Coretta Scott King was a part of this as well. She's not just you know, the wife at home kind of thing. She was involved in some of these discussions. Even though she fretted for her family quite extensively, and very rightly so, it's not as though she was a back burner character that just stood by her husband and looked nice for photos. She actually did do a lot of things while he was jailed. She had to probably take on some of these things, much to her chagrin, I'm sure.
That's a good point. You also brought up that, you know, there's a lot of other characters behind the scenes with Dr. King. They don't all agree with each other, and it's great to see that. It's great to see, you know, it's not just about, like, look how great blacks are while the whites are horrible. Like, it's not that kind of movie. It's showing you a lot of different layers within the same, you know, the same camps and whatnot.
Yeah.
And that's
basically my point about, it's not just about Dr. Martin Luther King. It is mostly about the movement and his march from Selma to Montgomery. But there's a lot of other people that were involved in it. It's not as though it's saying Dr. Martin Luther King did this single-handedly and it went off without a hitch. There were a lot of problems. There were a lot of internal struggles.
Like Bunk
from the Wire's there. And, like, it was not easy. And that's one of the best things about this movie. So it did remind me a lot of Lincoln, too. It's slice of life. It's not about the entire presidency. And it was just about how hard it was for him to get past the 13th Amendment. Even though he himself had some struggles, I think Mark Hoban brought this up during our Lincoln review, but he's like, you know, he had a discussion with one of the persons who worked at the White House, and it's like, he doesn't exactly address her the most splendidly, like President Lincoln doesn't exactly address her the most splendidly. So even though he is seen as the emancipator of
the
slaves,
great emancipator, yeah,
it's not as though he had some, he probably had other feelings as well.
With that in mind, Abe, I mean, you've seen the movie now, and I know it's only been a little while. Would you addendum your top 10 to include this in some way?
It's hard for me to say that. It's not one of those that it knocks me off of my seat kind of thing, and says I have to put it into the top 10. I'm not sure yet, because I thought about that after I watched it too, and like in terms of what you had said earlier with Todd as well, it's in terms of, you know, your favorites versus what's really good. I don't think that I would amend my top 10, but it's in, like, the top 12.
Okay. Well, it's certainly a movie that you recognize as being very, very good.
Yes, it is, again, competently made, but also the story is very, very well done.
Okay, well, I want to move on just because we've, you know, been going long as it is, and we already have two reviews here. So with that in mind, I feel like we could all just say, go see Selma, right? I think that's a common thing.
Yes.
Okay, in a world where Taken 3 makes $40 million in a weekend and Selma only makes 11, it's like, all right, well, some people were winners this weekend. All right. So that's it. Let's go to our sponsor real quick. Each week's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/shotnowpodcast. There are over 150,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or any kind of MP3 player. I did not find a specific book, but I can just assume that there are a lot of Martin Luther King Jr. books you can probably find. So you can check out audibletrial.com/shotnowpodcast and look up Martin Luther King Jr., and I'm sure you can find something, or anything else that you'd want.
Yeah.
If you go to audibletrial.com/podcast, you can get a free audiobook download. There's a free 30-day trial that comes with that. If you don't like the service, you can get rid of it, but you get to keep the book that you downloaded for free anyway. So with all that in mind, be a winner, read.
Yay.
Or listen. audibletrial.com/podcast. Okay. let's move on now. Let's get to Out Now feedback. This is, of course, where we go over some of the questions and answers that we got on our Facebook page, facebook.com/shotnowpodcast. Real quick stuff, just because we already had two reviews going, so I just had two questions, and we have one question asked to us.
Yep.
But Abe, you want to start that one off?
Absolutely, yeah. So the first question we asked everyone is, what is everyone's favorite Paul Thomas Anderson film? Manish writes Boogie Nights and Punch Drunk Love. I recently joined the There Will Be Blood bandwagon also. Jose, friend of the show, writes, PTA is my great cinematic blind spot. The only PTA film I've seen is Punch Drunk Love, so I guess that's my favorite. I may have to add catching up on PTA's filmography to my resolutions for 2015.
Yeah, I was shocked to hear this from Jose.
I know.
And he will not be on this podcast until you were
The Legend of Korra one, though, that's a different story.
For sure. I'm a huge Punch Drunk Love fan. And Boogie Nights used to be like my de facto favorite, but I'm kind of, every time I think about Punch Drunk Love, I'm like, I think I like this the most of his films. Mm. Todd, what's your favorite PTA film?
Well, Boogie Nights is my favorite movie of all time.
There you go.
So, it is my favorite of his movies, but, Magnolia was on TV like 2 weeks ago, and I just sat down and it was, you know, more than an hour before the end, and I was like, I'll watch this for 5 minutes while I drink a soda. And next thing I knew, like, the movie was over. You know, I mean, like, I love Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love is, I think, such a remarkable, underrated movie.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I think, you know, people are more dismissive of it in the context of his other movies, and maybe understandably so, but I mean, like, it's a movie where, not unlike The Master or even Inherent Vice, where there's so much more going on than you think that there is. I mean, in terms of just its execution, I mean, you know, the fact that there's, I think, a lens flare in every single shot of the movie.
Take that, J.J. Abrams.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, like, I just love that, you know, and I love the way that it's done, and it's so sweet. And it's funny how, you know, that movie in particular, you think about how now the idea of sort of the manic pixie dream girl has become like kind of a cliche, and how that movie could sort of, in a very broad, I think, and reductive way, be sort of lumped in with those, where we'd be like, oh wow, great, like if only, you know, like introspective white guys could find, you know, perfect girls, you know, and not have to change at all, and they find somebody to completely accept them, you know, which is what every one of these movies seems to have become for these like young romantic comedies. Mm-hmm. And yet there is, again, there is a real complexity, there's a pain to Barry's existence, which this woman, because of her upbringing and not having any siblings, like, provides this like really like encouraging, supportive counterpoint to, that you find, that, you know, becomes like a real believable sort of chemistry between these two people. It's really amazing. I mean, yeah. it's a gorgeous movie, and it's a wonderful movie. But I mean, Boogie Nights, I would say, I saw that, how many times? I saw that movie like 14 times in the theater. So it is one
14 times.
That, yeah.
Wow.
During its initial run, I saw it 12, and then I've seen it since then a couple more times. So
good on you. One quick note about Magnolia: if you want to see John C. Reilly in a dramatic role, watch Magnolia. He's really good in it.
Magnolia, yeah, he's the epitome of like teddy bear.
Yeah, no, but I mean, when he loses his pistol, that part still makes me sad. Like when he's, you know, looking for it. But
yeah, absolutely.
Okay, the next question here we have is, what do you like to see in biopics in terms of guys' style, structure, casting, etc.? And Alessandro answers, I find myself preferring movies that focus on a specific event or period in a person's life, like Invictus or Lincoln. That shows what kind of person he was, rather than a three-hour epic that tries to cram in his or her entire life story.
You should go watch Selma.
Yeah. Manish has, I prefer strong narrative and actual movie direction over a visual history book. Sure, it's nonfiction, but that doesn't mean it can't be stylistic and creative. It's funny we mentioned that. Todd, have you seen Mr. Turner?
You know, I started watching that. I was in the process of cramming for the LA Film Critics vote, mm-hmm. and I sat down to watch that, and I got about 25 minutes in, and I was like, I'm not going to have time. I'm not going to make it through this, because I love Mike Lee, but that was a movie that I just found such a sort of slog in a way. I like, there's a part of me that wants to go back and rewatch it, but you know, unfortunately I don't feel altogether compelled to like make the time for it.
Yeah. It's the, cause I did see it, this past, week, and I actually really liked it, but I think it's the kind of movie where it does help to be in a theater where you're kind of closed off from distractions and,
yeah.
And I mean,
I believe that.
Yeah. And cause it's, you know, it's a 2.5 hour film about a guy that paints, and yes, he has quirks. It's Timothy Spall, and he basically plays him as a pig. Like, that's the kind of the, he grunts and all of his grunts mean different things. It's humorous in its own way, but it's also, it's hard to say, yeah, that was an entertaining joy of a blast of a film. But I mean, it's, I bring it up because it fits the style of biopic where it is very much invested in the character, and it does a lot of things that biopics don't traditionally do, where it's not necessarily providing you with the, here are all the major points and here's big flags of when this thing happened and when this thing happened, and instead it tries to, it shows you how his kind of style of painting involves based on just kind of dialogue and what you're seeing visually. I mean, the movie's, by the way, like Dick Polk's cinematography in that film is tremendous, but it's the kind of hard one where it's like, I can't say like, man, everyone should go see Mr. Turner, but at the same time it's like, there's a really good movie here that you maybe need to be in a certain mood for, and yeah, having a theater where you're closed off from everything around you and you can just sit and enjoy something like this to the extent that you can, you know, a 2.5 hour drama about J.W.M. Turner. But it certainly kind of fits this kind of this preferred version of a biopic where it's not like just highlighting like point after point after point, which is something like, I think the closest example I can think of is Mandela, where Idris Elba and Naomi Harris, they did a good job as Nelson Mandela and Winnie Mandela in that film. But I mean, it's 2.5 hours of trying to cram everything in about the man's life. And for one thing, you can't do that unless you're, you know, the best filmmaker ever, given all the things he accomplished. But it's hard to be sit and just kind of watching to see like kind of standard things happen of like, and then he did this, and then this happened, and then drama beat, and then, oh, like my moment of triumph, like this kind right. of bullet points. So seeing films like Selma, or seeing film like Lincoln, or even this Mr. Turner, like it does a really good job of kind of pointing out certain aspects of their lives that, you know, matter without making it into kind of into a history lesson, essentially. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's our answers there.
Yeah. And then we had a question that Jose asked us, which we'd like to hear Aaron and Todd speak about, and myself as well. What spring TV premieres are you guys looking forward to, both returning shows and new premieres?
I mean, Game of Thrones will come back, Veep will come back, Silicon Valley coming. I mean, HBO. they do their thing.
Pretty much, yeah. Veep and Archer's back on.
Archer's back on now. You know, it's winter. So. You do much TV, Todd?
Not a whole lot, but I mean, like I was going to say, you know, basically I agree in that, that, you know, mine tends to run to HBO and stuff like that. I mean, those are the shows that I'm most excited for. When I heard, I guess yesterday or the day before, that they had announced the season 5 premiere for Game of Thrones. I was very excited.
I'm trying to think of new stuff that's coming. There's stuff coming on like now, like tonight, like the new Duplass Brothers show, Togetherness.
That's on HBO.
It's basically HBO.
Yeah.
But let me see if I can find something real quick.
Backstrom looks kind of interesting.
Yeah, I like Rainn Wilson. I'm curious to see what he does post
office. I was kind of, what happened to the Fox show with I want to say MacGruber. I can't remember his name. MacGruber being the last name.
That looks great.
Yeah.
It's March? Okay, like March. The last man on Earth.
The last man on Earth, and it's from it's a collaboration between Will Forte and Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who, of course, love. So,
yeah.
No problem there. You know, actually, no. You know, there's the Netflix Daredevil show I'm very curious about. I'm very curious where that's going to be.
There's a trailer that I didn't watch for that yet.
It's not really a trailer. It's more of just like, here's the poster. It's movies. Oh, okay. Like, that's the trailer for it. But yeah, that is one I'm very interested in. I'm curious to see how that goes. And of course, there's the final season of Mad Men's coming as well. So, all right, that was feedback.
Feedback.
And now, Abe, I think it is time for the 2015 return
of games. That was majestic.
I thought so. That was, yeah, of course, the improv theme for games. And I have a... in my mind, this game sounded very cool to me. Of course, and Todd, this is your first time playing games with us. Basically, Abe and I come up with a new game every week to both challenge and perplex the other parties involved. This one might work really well. It's called You Speechifying Over There.
And, okay.
Yeah. So basically, because Selma, which does not feature any of Martin Luther King's speeches because they're trademarks, which was interesting to learn after the fact. It's like, huh, I didn't hear any of his speeches. I have a game where I've basically assembled a lot of famous movie speeches, and I'm going to read them and one at a time.
Movie and, speeches, okay. Yes,
and if you can figure out what the movie is or who's saying it or something along those lines before I finish said speech, you get a point.
Okay.
So just feel all free to shout it out, because some of these are longer than others.
Let's do it.
So like this first one might be pretty easy just to kind of set the tone for it, but then from there on it might get a little harder. Okay, so here we go. Here's the first one. Good morning. In less than an hour, aircraft from here. Yeah.
Independence Day, Bill Pullman.
Yes. You got
yes.
Right,
wow. Best presidential speech.
I said good morning in less than an hour, and you got it. That was yeah. Impressive.
Okay. I was thinking that Todd was going to get on it. I was like, I got to jump in.
I was waiting to get to – I want to get to the one sentence because I want to say, and you'll be launching the largest aerial battle in the history of mankind. Pause.
Yeah.
Mankind. That word should have new meaning for all of us today. Okay, here's the next one. So, yeah, feel free to just jump in, shout your name to buzz
okay.
in. And yeah, all right. Here we go. Here's the next one. Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows.
Yeah. Rocky 6.
Rocky Balboa is, yeah.
Yeah, right. Rocky Balboa.
Wow.
Okay.
Come on, Todd.
Okay.
What you got?
Here we go. So okay, now these might get tougher.
All right. The tougher ones I'm not so good with, Todd. Just
okay,
really being honest.
Okay. There we go.
Well, I'm not doing too well so far anyway. So.
Okay, here we go. Now, this is another thing I want you to remember. I don't want to get any messages saying that we are all holding up our position. We're not holding anything. Let the Hun do that. We're advancing constantly, and we're not interested in holding on to anything except the enemy. We're going to hold on to him by the nose, and we're going to kick him in the ass. We're going to kick the hell out of him all the time, and we're going to go through him like crap through a goose.
The Huns? Hmm. That part throws me
because
off.
Because I have so many more. That was from Patton.
Ah, I was like, the Hun. Yeah, it sounded
the
like.
Hun. I said, let the Hun do that. But,
oh, okay.
Yeah, okay. Here we go. This is a short one. I wish I could say something classy and inspirational, but that just wouldn't be our style. Pain heals, chicks dig scars, glory lasts forever.
Chicks dig scars. Ugh.
I actually know this, and I.
Describe
you know
the movie.
You know who said it?
Oh, my God.
Pain heals, chick dig scars.
I wish I could say something classy and inspirational, but that just wouldn't be our style.
Oh, I feel like it's I don't know it, but I feel
you're
like,
gonna freak when you know it.
I know exactly. That's what I was gonna say. I was like, I don't know this right now, but I feel as though I'm gonna like.
It was, of course, the immortal Keanu Reeves as Shane Falco in The Replacements.
Oh my God! I actually did know that. Oh, that's terrible.
I know.
That's terrible. It's worse that I know it than
you know it. You don't know it.
Shane Falco. Chicks.
I didn't know Patton, but I know The freaking Replacement.
Yeah.
The Replacements
is a movie that I could watch like anytime it's on TV. It's like, yeah, all right.
It's fun.
Like,
no, not? it's a lot of fun.
It
I agree.
Is. Gene Hackman with a mustache. You know.
Yeah.
These are the things you point out. Okay. Here we go. Here's the next one. We will be perfect in every aspect of the game. You drop a pass, you run a mile. You miss a blocking assignment, you run a mile. You fumble the football, yeah.
Denzel Washington, Remember the Titans?
It is Remember the Titans, and that was my Denzel Washington impression.
Huh. I know that if you had done your Denzel, it would have been like crazy, right?
I was doing, but for a speech, that was a pretty good Denzel.
Oh, okay, all right.
All right, okay. moving on.
I'm doing real good so far.
You had one, kind of.
Yeah. After you told me, I definitely had it. Okay. Yeah.
Here we go. 3 weeks from now, I will be harvesting my crops.
Abe.
Yeah?
Maximus.
Wow, you
Buddy.
Know his speech? Jesus.
Oh, my God.
We did not rehearse this.
No, we didn't.
Yeah, right.
Okay. If you put in your effort and concentration into playing to your potential... To be the best, I can let me say that. Let me thought. Jesus, okay. I said all punctuations all over the place. Let me try again. If you put your effort and concentration into playing to your potential, to be the best that you can be. I don't care what the scoreboard says at the end of the game. In my book, we're going to be winners.
Mm.
I'll give you a hint. One of the actors I just mentioned.
Abe, yeah, Hoosiers.
It's Hoosiers, yes, that's correct.
I was like, where else would they...
1986, yeah. Jesus.
Okay, this one might be a giveaway, let's see. Great moments are born from great opportunity. And that's what you have here tonight, boys. That's what you have earned here tonight. One game, if we played them 10 times, they might win not.
Yeah, I got it.
Yep.
It's Varsity Blues.
It's not Varsity Blues.
Oh! It's not Varsity Blues. Oh, my God.
I don't know. It's some football movie.
Let me get to the last sentence. You
or
might
is it a baseball
movie? Let me get to the last sentence.
All right.
I'm sick and tired of hearing about what great hockey team the Soviets have. Screw them. This is your time. Now go out there and take it. What'd you say?
Todd, you got
that
this.
That would be Miracle,
it would
right?
be Miracle. That's yeah, correct.
I think Todd should still get that point.
I gave him that point.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, the thing is that, like, the speech that What's-His-Face gives in Varsity Blues is...
It's very similar, yeah.
Of course, all these speeches are very similar. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, it's from Star Wars. I'm just going to keep saying that until it's right.
Okay, here we go. A few more. Okay. Hold your ground, sons of Gondor of Rohan. My brothers, I see.
Well, it would be from Return of the King.
That is correct. Yes.
Okay.
Return of the King. Here's the next one, also very similar. Children, gather round. No retreat, no surrender. That is Spartan law. And by
that would be 300.
That is 300.
Yes, if you include like the character or the destination right, or the yeah. name of the movie thought, in it, I will remember. You're like, all 300 of us will work together.
That
like,
is the end of that quote, yeah.
Of course, I'll be like, oh, that's Gladiator, right?
I thought about either blanking out those parts or like putting in different
numbers. That would have been more confusing.
I know. Okay, here's the next one. I want you to take a moment, and I want you to look each other in the eyes. I want you to put each other in your hearts forever, because forever is about to happen here in a few minutes. I want you to close your eyes, and I want you to think about Booby Miles, who is your brother. He would die to be out there in that field with you tonight. And I want you to put that in your hearts, boys. My heart is full. My heart is full.
Booby Miles. I mean, like,
I thought that was the giveaway.
Booby Miles. You're also doing an accent.
Mm-hmm.
Booby Miles.
A giant friend of the show is associated with this, Abe.
A giant friend of the show? Like the original friend of the show?
No. The one that's constantly mentioned. That won't help Todd at all.
Yeah.
Booby Miles. There is a TV series inspired by this film.
Oh, hey, Friday Night Lights.
Todd said it.
I think Todd got it, yeah. See, I was going to say Friday Night Lights, but I was like, no, that's a TV show.
Yeah.
So.
Billy Bob, give a speech. Okay, two more. Here we go. We're going to go inside. We're going to go outside, inside and outside. We're going to get them on the run, boys. And once we get them on the run, we're going to keep them on the run. And we're going to go, 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 go. We're not going to stop till we get across that goal line. This is a team that they say is good. Well, I think we're better than them. They think they can't lick us. So what do you say, man? Imagine I was only standing like 5'5" when I was saying that speech.
5'5". Abe, Little Giants.
Nope.
It
wasn't the icebox.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's Rudy. It's a Rudy speech.
Rudy. Oh, okay. All right. Well, Rick Moranis is like 5'5", too.
I know. Last one. Last one. This might be the best speech of them all. What? Over? Did you say over? Nothing's over until we decide it is. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no. And it ain't over now, because when the going gets tough...
Oh, yes, yes, I know. This is from Animal House.
It is Animal House, that's correct.
Yes. That one I know.
Good job, Todd.
Anything involving drinking, I definitely know.
Well, Todd came on strong at the end.
Todd came on, yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, we have a tie, guys.
Oh, whoa, tie. I've never been involved in a tie before.
I don't think you have, Abe. Okay, so obviously the way to determine the winner of a tie, I'm going to look up the box office total of a speech I didn't use, Any Given Sunday.
Okay.
And you're both going to guess what Any Given Sunday made domestically.
Okay, I want to say, I think that it was kind of a hit. My gut's saying $46 million.
Todd, what would you say Any Given Sunday made?
Well, that's about what I would say, too. But I'll go a little lower. I'll say 40.
Oh, you should have went over. It made 75 million domestic.
75?
Yeah.
What?
People wanted to see what's apparently a 2 hour and 37 minute movie. I did not realize it was that long.
That is a long movie.
That was a lot. Okay. Any given Sunday. Yeah. So, Abe, that makes you the de facto winner of.
I'm going to share this with you, Todd. You know, because if we can change.
A quote I very much considered using, by the way. I thought that was too easy. I got the Sunshine and Rainbows one. So
yeah, you got that one.
Okay. So that's games. That's you speechifying over there.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do a little Out Now presents What's Out Now. These are movies coming out on DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming this week. And we got a few here. We have Gone Girl.
Go see it.
We have A Walk Among the Tombstones, which...
Aaron says it's not that great.
I like Walk Among the Tombstones. Okay. It's a hell of a lot better than Taken 3, that's for damn sure. Jimmy All By My Side. This was the Jimi Hendrix biopic from John Ridley, who wrote 12 Years a Slave.
Mm.
It's got its moments. I saw it the other day, actually.
Oh, is that the one with Andre 3000?
With Andre Benjamin, okay. Yeah, as Jimmy. That's similar to how Selma can't use any of the speeches, that movie couldn't use any of Jimmy's songs, which is a little like, huh, I feel like I should be hearing something here. Mm. Let's see, there's Love is Strange with Alfred Molina and John Lithgow. I really like this movie quite a bit.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah. The Two Faces of January, I believe that's Viggo Mortensen and Kristen Dunst. And Oscar Isaac, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh,
I think it's Oscar. A Patricia Highsmith movie from, like, she did Talented Mr. She wrote the books of Talented Mr. Ripley and so on. That's one of those. It's not a Ripley movie, but just one of her books adapted into a film. And lastly, Boardwalk Empire, the final season. Did you watch Boardwalk Empire, Todd?
No, I haven't watched it, unfortunately. Yeah. It's one of those ones where they would send me, like, the Blu-rays, and I'm like, I'm going to watch this. Mm-hmm. And then, like, something would, you know, I'd be, like, covered in movies or it'd be Comic-Con or something, and I'm like, I'll get to it afterward, and then I'd forget. So yeah.
I watched the whole series, and overall, I am a fan of it. I think it never quite got to kind of the potential one would hope for with a Martin Scorsese-produced period drama starring Steve Buscemi, which, you know, screams, that's the best show ever. It certainly had its peaks, I believe, in, like, the second and third season, but the final season was really strong as well. So if anyone ever wants to catch up with Boardwalk Empire, those are my thoughts on it. last thing before we get to the end here. What should people go and see now, and what do you plan to see next? So, Todd, what should people go and see in theaters right now?
Well, I think, Selma is a movie that I think everybody should definitely go see. I mean, it's easy to say movies are important and therefore worthy of going to see, but this is a movie that is not just important, it's like hugely resonant and thought-provoking in the best possible way. Simultaneously, I would say go see Inherent Vice because it's great and it's tons of fun. I mean, you know, not to revisit every one of our points, but I'll tell you, man, Brolin is such an MVP in that movie. He's just so funny start to finish. And you know, while at the end, you know, and at the same time, like really like kind of like funnily kind of almost sad that that you know you get to the end you're like, wow, I kind of feel bad for this guy in spite of the fact that he's such a huge dick.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But he gets yelled at by his wife.
Yeah, that
Christian
scene is so great.
Christian,
and don't walk around like a dog that just got beaten or something like that. It just killed me. Yeah.
Can you just do it for one day?
What do you plan to see next, Todd?
What do I plan to see next? You know, I'm seeing Black Hat on Monday.
I'll see you there.
my fingers are crossed that it will be good, although I've heard not so good things. You know, I mean, I like, but then again, you know, Michael Mann, like sort of his post insider output has been pretty uneven for me personally.
Uneven,
so.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm a huge Collateral fan, so I mean, it's...
Yeah, I like Collateral, but I mean, I didn't like Miami Vice.
My advice and Public Enemy is a movie that you don't remember until you say it.
I did forget about that.
exactly. Exactly.
Like, is that the one with Johnny Depp and Christian Bale?
Yeah, that's one. That's one of the few Johnny Depp roles where he's not playing a zany character in the past 10 years.
Yeah,
that's Public Enemies.
Oh, so bad.
But I reflect what you're saying. So I mean, I'd say Selma, see Inherent Vice, see anything that's up for an award right now. There's not really much you can go wrong with in that realm. And yeah, Black Hat's what I am gonna see next.
Yeah,
what would you recommend?
I'm gonna recommend, you guys are already recommend some good movies, but I'm gonna put in top five. If you guys haven't seen top five, definitely go see it. I think it's one of the pretty well made movie as well. And then what am I gonna see next? Jennifer Lopez classic Boy Next Door.
Nice. Okay.
Oh man.
Yeah, things are wet out here. Oh my god.
I love your mother's cookies.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
I'm like Chrissy Blackhead and not gonna watch The Boy Next Door.
And speaking of, actually, I forgot to go. I went right over next week. Next week's show, we might talk Black Hat. That might be just quickies because I think American Sniper is the film that we're going to talk more.
If it's open wider, yeah.
You don't know. It opens wide next week in IMAX, no less. So, you know, plenty of people to get the American Sniper fix if they want it. But okay. Yeah, that's going to be the main review for next week's show. And with that said, that's going to do it for this week's episode of Out Now with Aaron and Abe. You can find more of my work on my personal blog, thecodeazeek.com, where you can find all my movie reviews, as well as at ysubblue.com for all my Blu-ray and movie reviews there. You can also follow me on Twitter at aaronsps4. Abe?
You can find more fun stuff at walrusmoose.blogspot.com and twitter.com/walrusmoose, hashtag Veep Season 3.
And Todd, where can people find more of your work online?
Well, they can find it if they can read Chinese at mtime.com. But otherwise, you can follow my always indisputably brilliant, witty, and insightful comments and observations about everyday things on Twitter at MT Gilchrist. And I say that that's completely true. I'm not being arrogant or anything. They're all just brilliant. So I'm just letting you guys know.
I've read them and I've been blown away. Like literally, like it's like opening up the suitcase from Pulp Fiction. It's just gold in my face.
Yeah, no. If you wanna watch somebody just say dumb shit all day, MT Gilchrist. I take a lot of pictures of my cats, which you can see on Instagram at Best Dressed Todd. Otherwise, I just you might see me because I follow you around.
All right.
Yeah.
You can, of course, find all the other episodes of Out Now with Aaron and Abe, including our fantastic Top 10 show from last week on iTunes and at Stitcher, as well as at hhwlod.com. That is the podcast network that hosts our show, along with other fun shows like the Walking Dead TV podcast, Legion of Dudes, and other fun comics and TVs and video game-related shows like that.
You can also find our episodes over at outnow.podomatic.com, as well as soundcloud.com/outnowpodcast.
Feel free to email us your thoughts on Selma, Inherent Vice, or whatever else you might have seen recently at outnowpodcast@gmail.com.
You can also interact with us over at facebook.com/outnowpodcast, or you can tweet at us at twitter.com/outnow_podcast.
And, of course, there is our Tumblr page, outnowpodcast.tumblr.com, and feel free to use our voicemail line, 972-798-3830, to send us an audio note of sorts, and we might be able to play it on the show and respond in some way. So, with all that said, Todd Gilchrist, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you guys so much for inviting me. I had a great time.
Good, yeah. And, of course, you mentioned Tokyo Drift, so that's one of the key ways to get back on the show. So, of course, you're welcome to come back at some point.
Sure, sure.
And, that's going to do it for this week's episode. So until next time when we talk about how good of a sniper Bradley Cooper actually is, that's going to do it. So long.
And goodbye. It's like opening up the suitcase from Pulp Fiction. It's just gold in my face.